It was Valentine's Day in 1989 when Salman Rushdie got a call from a BBC reporter. She asked him how it felt to be sentenced to death by the Ayatollah Khomeini. He told her it didn't feel good, and he thought, "I'm a dead man." So began Rushdie's long public imprisonment. The fatwa, 9 years living under the threat of murder because of a book he'd written, The Satanic Verses. It's The Record. I'm Steve Scherr. Khomeini is long gone, but Salman Rushdie, award-winning writer, leader of a movement for freedom of speech, survived. He chronicles the toll it took on him and the lessons he learned in a new book, Joseph Anton. Salman Rushdie joins us. It's good to talk to you again.
Hi, nice to be back. Thank you.
Joseph Anton. This is a book in the third person, and you write about Joseph Anton. Who was Joseph Anton?
Well, Joseph Anton's me. I mean, I got asked to come up with a false name, partly in order to rent properties to live in and so on, but mainly so that the police who were looking after me could train themselves to not use my real name by accident when in public and thus kind of blow the cover of where I was staying. So they said, come up with a name. And I had no idea what kind of a name to make up. And in the end, just started fooling around with the names of writers I admired. And it came down to this, which is Joseph from Joseph Conrad and Anton from Anton Chekhov. So Joseph Anton, which I thought was at least a plausible name, you know, this kind of name that somebody might actually have. And then I had to live under that name partly, you know, for a decade.
Was he?
I hated it. We had a backstory for him. He was some kind of international publishing man of mystery. He was a sort of publishing Howard Hughes.
That's nice. You hated it? What did you think of...
I hated the name, having to use it.
Yeah. What did you... But he does become... I know it's you, but there is this person that you look at from a distance, this Joseph Anton.
Now it's a kind of a useful way of suggesting to readers that the person that I'm writing about, the younger self that I'm writing about, is to some degree a little bit different than the older self who's doing the writing. You know, different in that he's younger, different in that all this stuff hasn't happened to him yet that then happened to me. So he's maybe not as wise, you know, not as experienced in what was going to happen. And that younger self was under colossal political, emotional pressure, almost deforming pressure, you know, which shaped his choices and actions. And I'm now, in the moment of writing the book, fortunately free of that and able to write in a calmer and more objective way, I hope.
You didn't like the police calling you Joe? Is that accurate?
I never felt like Joe. But I could see why they were doing it, but I was there was a particular day when he was laid to rest and we never had to use him again, and I was very happy about that day.
You know, names are a big part of this book, and I was, what a great story it was to find out that the name Rushdie is also a name that was created.
Yes, my father made it up. He wanted, what happens in old-fashioned Indian Muslim culture is that you don't actually have a fixed family name, that you take my father's first name was Anis, so in the old-fashioned way, that would become my last name, so that would be Salman Anis, and then my sons would take my name, my first name, as their last name, and so on. So there isn't like a continuity of a family name, and he thought that was sort of confusing in the modern world, and he chose this name Rushdie because he was an admirer of the 12th century Spanish-Arab philosopher Ibn Rushd, known in the West as Averroes, a great commentator on Aristotle and so on, and in his time, a great rationalist and humanist. And then to my surprise, as I read about him, discovered that my father in a way couldn't have picked a better name because he, Ibn Rushd, in his time, was fighting against the fundamentalists of his time, of the Spanish-Arab world. And there was a point where he was sent into exile and his books were burned and he was sort of sent into disgrace. And I thought, gosh, my dad really picked the right name here. And he was, in the case of his story, by the end of his life, he was rehabilitated and, you know, died with honor and dignity. So, and was a great philosopher. And representative, if you like, of a kind of progressive, rationalist, logical voice inside Islamic philosophy. And that's why my father admired him.
You know, you write about how your father, how would you describe your father?
Well, I describe him as a very brilliant man who unfortunately didn't have the life that he wanted. I mean, he was an only child. His father died when he was relatively young, a young man, and he had to sort of take over the family business and look after his mother. But he was not really suited to that kind of life, to the life of a businessman and entrepreneur. He was much more suited to a life of reflection and scholarship. So he was pushed in a direction he didn't want to go. And I think he increasingly became an unhappy man, which is what drove him to drink. But one of the things I like that I was able to do in this book is to write about, in a way, how much intellectually I owed him, how many of his preoccupations became mine, how much of his way of thinking, his religious skepticism, for example, became mine. And I know very well that, I mean, he sadly didn't live long enough to read the Satanic Verses, but I know very well that if he had done so, it would have been his favorite book of mine, because it was the one that spoke to really to his real concerns and interests.
And he would have been, Salman Rushdie, he would have been behind you, backing you in your fight.
Oh, I think
fight.
No question. Because a lot of the ideas in the book are actually his ideas revamped by me.
You know, you wrote about Conrad. This came across in a number of places. I must live till I die. That's what Conrad wrote. How did that idea sustain you?
Well, you know, it's of course a very famous line of Conrad's, but what I understood it to mean was try and go on being yourself. You know, don't shrivel up and hide in a corner and quake with fear. You know, write your books, tell your stories, argue your corner, fight. You know, stand up for yourself. Be a father to your children. Be a friend to your friends. You know, go on living. Go on having as full a life as you can. And I tried to follow that precept.
And you talk about this story, Joseph Anton. You talk about this is a story of freedom lost and regained. But I was wondering, what did you lose and what is still lost?
Well, I mean, I lost 10 years of my life, essentially. You know, and that's to say, you know, I was 41 when this trouble began in my life, and more or less a decade older when it ended. Now, I mean, a man's 40s are, you know, normally thought to be the prime of his life, you know, and I spent my 40s essentially in jail fighting against, you know, the risk of assassination, not only for myself, but for everybody else named in the threats, that's to say translators, publishers, etc. And there were attacks, as you know, on many of those people. So I feel as if that very important moment of my life was taken from me. It was very difficult for me to be a good father to my son, who was my older son was 9 when this trouble began. And I had to, I mean, I think actually we have managed to maintain a very close relationship and are very close today, perhaps closer, because we went through this storm together. But there were many things that dads everywhere would assume that they would do with their sons, like, you know, kick a football in a park, like, you know, knock a tennis ball around, like, you know, just hang out with your kids, take them on holiday, go to a beach. All of these things became either colossally difficult or impossible in those years. And that's something I'll never get back.
Joseph Anton, Salman Rushdie's new book, out in paperback, on the record, on KUOW Seattle. You know, you came here to Seattle. I remember when you came here. And I remember the first time you came, we were under strict orders not to reveal you were coming. We couldn't even say anything on the air, couldn't say anything beforehand. This was typical for you. This was the typical way you were living your life for a decade, in the shadows.
Well, it was very difficult. I mean, very hard, you know, if you're trying to. I mean, that was, I believe, 1995 at the time that The Moor's Last Sigh came out. And I was trying my hardest to have some kind of, you know, a book tour, to present the book to the public. And very hard to do that when, you know, when the media are told you can't say he's coming. So it was a, I don't know, it was an insane, surrealist situation to be in. And this is better is all I could say.
How do you look at this book? You say in this book, and you said it on the air, it was a crazy time, and you were becoming unraveled. Do you see this as a way, how do you see this book looking back on that point when you're unraveling?
Well, I mean, I think one of the points about autobiography is you just have to agree with yourself that you will tell as much truth as possible, and that you have to tell truth that is unflattering to yourself, you know? I mean, nobody wants to read a book in which the author tells you how great he is for 600 pages and suggests that other people were maybe less great. I mean, that's a book nobody'd buy it, you know? Nobody'd buy the argument. So I think for readers to be interested in an autobiography, they have to feel that the person writing it has a pretty good take on himself, that he knows when he was weak, when he made mistakes, when he stumbled, etc., and that he's willing to talk about that. So I mean, I thought, I have to go into it with that point of view. Otherwise, don't write the book. But if you're going to write the book, tell as much truth as you can.
So you had to do that with your personal life as well, with your marriages.
Yes. Yeah, up to a point. I mean, I felt that there were things I had to put in because without that, it wouldn't explain why the story went the way it did. But there were things which I didn't put in. I mean, I showed the book, you know, to various of the people in the book, and there were things they asked me to take out, which I did. So because I wasn't really trying to blindside people.
May I say that I interviewed Marianne Wiggins, it was her novel. So it was after the fatwa, before you came, and there was a clear strain in the conversation when you came up.
Uh-huh.
That must have been very, very hard to be both public and private.
Well, you know, it was a relationship that was falling apart even before the trouble began, and it didn't last much longer. That was probably the one of the most difficult things to write about.
You know, you also write that Haroon and the Sea of Stories revived you. You had made a promise to your son, and you found a way to fulfill that promise. Do you remember what happened? What was the shift for you when you were looking at your desk and you said, "This is the job I have to do"?
Well, I had fallen into a kind of depression about my own writing because of what happened, and what this project of writing a book for my son did was it. Well, first of all, I wanted to make him feel happy, but it actually had the effect of rekindling my own joy in the work I'd always wanted to do, you know, which is the writing of books. And I do think it's very odd that the book, to me now, if I look at it now, it feels like a very joyful book. And it was written at anything but a happy time, you know. But it just gave me back my love of writing books, you know, and that's what it did for me. I mean, I think what it did for him was, I mean, I think I'm happy to say that he really loved the book, and now that he's grown up, he still does. So it worked as a gift from the father to a son. But he actually gave me a gift, really, by inspiring me to write it and giving me back my joy in my work.
You said that this book is about the novel, fiction, and the why we have fiction in part, what the redemptive part of fiction is, but also what the honest part of fiction is. Did fiction, was there a question about that because of the way this book, The Satanic Verses, was received, that fiction itself was in danger?
Well, I think certainly there was the people who were attacking the book appeared to have really no sense of how fiction operates. You know, they read fiction as being, you know, insults in disguise. He is hiding behind his fiction was something that people would say. And I felt that there was a kind of crisis about the novel itself, and that needed to be spoken for and spoken to and defended. And one of the things I try and say in the book is how important it is to understand that human beings, you know, all of us, not just professional writers, we are all storytelling animals. We are people, we are the only creature on the earth that tells stories in order to understand the kind of creature that we are. And so the telling of stories, whether privately, you know, whether privately for between friend and friend, between inside families, you know, family stories are a very important part of the identity of a family, or professional storytellers writing for readers. You know, this is all very close to the center of the business of being human. And I think that's why it needs to be protected and defended, because if we allow that to be eroded, that freedom, we're eroding something very central to our nature as human beings.
Why were they wrong to see that you to say that you were criticizing a religion, Islam, in the Satanic Verses? Weren't you? Looking at it that way?
Yeah, they weren't entirely wrong. I mean, what I did was, of course, ironize it in a number of ways. The religion in the novel is not called Islam. The prophet's not called Muhammad. The city's not called Mecca. And these scenes take place as dream sequences in the mind of somebody who's having a crisis of faith. That's the way it happens inside the novel. And that was all decontextualized and used to say that I was just in some crude, barbaric way insulting a religion. But actually, the fact is, there is no reason why religion should not be criticized. There's no way, it seems to me, in a genuinely free society, that you can ring-fence any idea and say, oh, you have to leave that alone. That's off-limits. That's a very dangerous precedent to set, and it's something that authoritarian regimes and tyrannies and religious bigotries, they always try and do it. They always say, you cannot question this, you can't talk about this, we tell you how to think about this, do what we say or else. And it's very, very important that writers, poets, intellectuals, journalists, private citizens retain the right to satirize, to speak irreverently, to debunk, to criticize any idea, whether secular or religious or sacred, whether it's communism or Islam, we have to retain the ability to laugh about it, to joke about it, to poke fun at it, to deconstruct it, to argue over it. If we can't do that, we're living in an unfree world.
Salman Rushdie is the author of 11 novels, a book of short stories, 3 works of nonfiction. The book he promised his young son he would write, Haroon and the Sea of Stories, was turned into an opera. His acclaimed novel, Midnight's Children, was named Best of the Booker Prize, covering the prize's 40-year history. It's been adapted for the stage. I want to ask you a little bit about death and deaths, because it was real. People died.
Yes, they did.
Protesting this book and defending this book. Translators, your Norwegian translator attacked, Japanese translator killed. What responsibility, and how do you put that responsibility into the world today? Do you bear? Do you feel?
Well, look, first of all, people attack my publishers and translators and people selling my book. You know, I felt terrible about it. I felt dreadful, and I did feel responsible. But I think, you know, if we look at this objectively, we have to see that people who commit acts of violence are responsible morally and criminally for the acts of violence they commit. You know, if I say something you don't like, that's one thing. If you respond to that by taking out a gun and shooting me, you're a murderer. You know, and my having said something you don't like is not a justification for you to carry out the crime you've carried out, and you will go to jail if there is justice. So it seems to me that the people who carried out acts of violence against the book and against its translators and publishers and booksellers, those are the people who bear the responsibility for the crimes. Because in any moral universe, we have responsibility for our actions, and the criminal is guilty of the crime, not the victim. You know, we have to get this right. It's not the target of the crime that is responsible for the crime. The crime was not committed by the author, the publisher, and the translators and booksellers of the Satanic Verses. The crime was committed against us, you know, and the responsibility lies with those people who committed it.
You know, in reading this book, a reader can tell that's a conversation you've had with many people, friends, and people who either were afraid or didn't want to get involved or wanted to disagree with you, you know, fight you for this. But I wonder how you see some of those people today, the publishers who backed off on publishing the books, the reporters and the literary people who said, no, Rushdie's gone too far, you have to make amends. How do you see those folks?
I'm not very close to them.
They weren't your friends in the end.
They weren't my friends in the end, you know. But, I mean, that's all right. One of the things that I say somewhere in the book is that fear makes good people do bad things. And I think there's no doubt that in that very heightened climate of very real danger, there were some people who blinked. You know, there were people who were too scared to become involved. There were people who were too scared to publish, people who wanted to say that it was my fault for having rocked the boat, you know. Why didn't you just shut up and then none of this would have happened? It was easy for people to do that. And some people, but what I remember more than that is the enormous act of solidarity that there was. I mean, I think, you know, the literary world, the publishing world, I would say the number of writers and publishers who were not sympathetic and supportive, you could probably count on the fingers of one hand, certainly two hands. So I remember that. I remember this extraordinary collective resolve that this matter was not going to end in defeat. You know, the way in which booksellers, who were really on the front line, you know, the bookshop is the most vulnerable place, the way in which booksellers continued to stock the book, to put it in the window, to sell it, to recommend it, and to do so in an unafraid way, that was heroic. That's the heroism of ordinary people, you know. And I think that the reason this battle ended the way it did, with the book, you know, having survived and the author having survived, is because of that. It's because of the heroism of ordinary people. It's because of people working in bookstores, people working in publishing companies, translators, editors, publishers, not people with power, not people with guns, just saying, we will not let this matter end in defeat. It's a matter of some pride to have been part of that collective act.
Salman Rushdie is chairman of the Penn World Voices Literary Festival. He's been awarded numerous fellowships, honorary doctorates, and awards. In part, those awards given for the political aspect of it, for standing up for voices that need to be heard in the world. What's the you know, you were famous for this, but there are thousands of writers who are feeling these oppressions every day.
Yes, unfortunately, it doesn't go away, the attack on writers. And it's one of the reasons why I became so involved with Penn American Center when I came to live in America, is that, you know, to try and do on behalf of other people what was so enthusiastically done on my behalf. And yes, if you look around the world, look at China, for example, you know, it's a terrible moment for free speech and for writers who try and speak freely. A certain amount of my time is spent you know, in that unfortunately endless work.
All right, but let's just touch on this to end this. Yes, it was horrible, no doubt about that. But yeah, you got to meet some pretty great people, and you got to hang out with Bono. you got to become a celebrity and a star. That comes through in this book too.
I get tables in restaurants. It's true. You know, if it was worth going through 10 years of that to get tables in restaurants, I think I probably, you know, earned it. Yes, I mean, I'm enough of a kind of fan of rock and roll to be very excited by the fact that I got to meet some of the people whose music I admired, and indeed to write a song for U2. That's very high on my personal CV. Not everybody gets to write the lyrics for a U2 song. But they made a song out of my lyrics to The Ground Beneath Her Feet. So there's that.
Well, you steep this book in historical analogies. You mentioned one, other writers who have suffered, and of course, you know, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, all those writers have suffered in part as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to ask you to make a judgment, and there's a little bit of ego involved, I know. But is this a historical moment? Does this rank with what we saw, and did we learn? Are we trying to learn something from this? Are you trying to have us learn something from this incident?
Well, what I try and say in the book is that I mean, it's a historical moment in that it became a very large event. You know, it became a kind of, it's very unusual for a world historical event to rest on the actions and choices of one individual, you know, and that's what happened. So that's, I mean, it's bizarre enough. But what I came to feel very strongly was that what happened to me was the precursor of much larger things that happened to all of us, and that you can see pretty much a straight line traveling from the fatwa against the satanic verses to the 9/11 attacks. You know, and I thought that one of the things that happened in this time and was visible, and I try to make visible in the book, is the growth and expansion and the increased virulence and ruthlessness of the phenomenon of Islamic extremism, as it was targeting first writers, journalists, intellectuals, dissidents, opponents, and then began to target the West as well. And you can see the growth of that project through the decade that followed the Khomeini fatwa against the satanic verses. And I came to feel, and I try and say it in the book, that what happened to me was like a prologue. It was like the opening notes of the music, you know, and the 9/11 attack is, if you like, the main event.
Then
there's a direct connection between them in terms of the growth of this phenomenon, Islamic extremism.
Are we seeing any waning of that? Or are we seeing? I mean, we look at Syria, we look at the anger involved across the Middle East, but you look at the Arab Spring, there was some hope for a while.
Yeah.
What do you think of what Hassan Rouhani is offering? Is that overture from the new leader of Iran give you any thought about where we're heading?
You know, I don't know. I mean, like everybody else, I want to hope for better times, you know, and I think there's no question that the new situation in Iran is an improvement on Ahmadinejad, but then on the other hand, it would be hard not to be an improvement on Ahmadinejad. How much of an improvement, how real it is, how much we can believe it or trust. I'm like most people, I'm pretty skeptical. I think the proof of it is in the doing of it.
You think literature came out of this, and I do mean this most broadly, and you're writing it that way too. Did literature come out of this better because of the voices that arose to sustain it?
I think better and worse. I think people did predominantly behave very well and stand up for and defended the principles that needed to be defended. But I do think that what has happened since is a growing fear of saying more or less anything at all about the subject area, you know, Islam, that from which these threats arose. So I think in some ways there has been a kind of chilling effect on free speech as a result of the fatwa. Other people are scared to tread on that turf. And I hope that fear fades in time.
The special police forces in the UK who protected you, when it was over, they shook your hand and they threw you a party. What did that mean?
Yeah. Well, I think they were very proud of what they'd done. As they said, it was one of the longest protections they ever had to undertake. It was considered to be the most dangerous protection that they had to do. It was considered that the risk level was considered to be higher than that against the danger was greater than that of the Queen, is what they said. And so the people who became involved in my protection, became a little bit kind of superstars inside the police force. You know, they were admired and respected for what they were doing, and then they felt they brought it to a happy ending, a satisfactory conclusion. And so they were very proud of it as a policing project. And I guess they and I had become pretty close. So, yeah, we had a party. We stayed in touch as well after the party.
Was that right? Still to this day? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
That's nice.
I find myself with all these friends in the secret police. Who knew?
Who knew? Salman Rushdie, his book is Joseph Anton, the memoir. It's out in paperback. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you.